everybody. My name is Barney Ruby, and I am an alcoholic. And I haven't had to take a drink since October the 19th of 1989, and that is really, really good by me. And everybody who knows and loves me, and even those who don't. I don't know if you realize just how lucky you are to have this meeting in this city where we have this depth of recovery every Tuesday night. So, really, one more time. Happy birthday, PCG. Thank you. It's really an honor to be asked to come up here for 10 minutes. But it really is. I'm really, really just honored to be here. I want to thank Katie and Charlie, and I also want to thank people that give a really kick-ass foundation meeting every week. If you come every week, you know what that means. And everybody else who's such a vital part of this. You know, every Tuesday night, Charlie can say, can I have volunteers to help clean up? And no less than 40 hands go up. And I don't know if you're going to see that in any other club. Not one. So let's just get started here. You know, it did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. I don't know about y'all, but that frankly just kind of irritated me when they wanted to make that point to me. Sure, I was powerless over my drinking. My life was a train wreck. All right, you can call that unmanageable if you want to. But to call me an outright mental defective and insane was frankly insulting. I mean, of course, there was reams and volumes of evidence that supported just that very fact. But, you know, I came in here very clear that I had drank myself into an insane state and drank myself into just a train wreck of misery and pain and despair. I know if you're sitting in this room right now, you understand what despair means, or you wouldn't be here and you wouldn't need to be, but we do. And so, but what I wanted to say was that I didn't hurt anybody but myself, you know, and that I could have stopped drinking if I wanted to. But I just really didn't want to, as if I had the ability to manage that decision. But I didn't want to, I could not face the fact that I had harmed all these people who loved me. My parents, my children, my spouse, my friends, what few there were left, you know? Because, you know, frankly, I was the kind, I didn't go out in bars and go crazy and get arrested and have that kind of behavior. I just stayed home. I just stayed home. And I didn't leave. And so I wanted to say, well, I didn't hurt anybody. And I have a great story that controverts that fact. I was sober for 8 years. And I traveled overseas with my mother. We went to go visit my brother. And I hadn't had a drink in 8 years. And I mean, you know, come on. I haven't had a drink in 8 years, for God's sakes, mother. And frankly, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I want a prize for doing the things that my mother had been doing her entire life, right? However, so I'm overseas, and I'm visiting my brother. It was in France, and, you know, they like to drink wine in France, you know? And, but my brother is very respectful of my alcoholism and provided me with some nice apple juice, what the children drink, but I'm not bitter. No. But he provided me the apple juice, and of course, it's very festive in France, and we have the right glasses and the right plates and the right meals and blah, 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 and it's very lovely. And so I'm drinking this apple juice, and I'm drinking it for several days, about 3 to 4 days, and my mother never says a word. And I'm drinking it in a goblet because it's kind of like being at the grown-up table. And I'm drinking my apple juice in a goblet. And on about day 4, my mother looks at the bottle, and she goes, "Oh, my God, that's not wine at all." And I went, "Well, of course it isn't, Mother. See, that's how I see me. Of course it isn't, Mother. But the damage I had done to my family and to my mother was such that 8 years in sobriety, she was still terrified that I would take a drink. That's not something we want to look at. That's something we want to ignore. But it's true." And when I really began to understand that this is the impact we have on people who love us, that this is the impact we have on people who care about us. Then I can begin to have a glimpse of humility, of the damage that we can do, the tornadoes we are roaring through people's lives. I have got to accept that about myself, and I have got to admit that about myself. No, I didn't just stay home. My parents were terrified what was happening to me. They could see me disintegrating before their eyes. They could see their grandchildren being neglected. They could see that I didn't answer the phone, that I didn't come home for Easter, that I didn't do any of these things. Right? I wanted to. I had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but I couldn't live up to them. And this is the impact we have on those who love us. Huh. Wow. So it says that years of living with an alcoholic is almost sure to make any wife or child neurotic. So we want to look. That's on page 122. I didn't make that up. And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I just want to go, hey, I'm sober. Give me a prize and get over it. Right? And they don't. And they don't. And so it says there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. And the next sentence is so important to me. It says, we must take the lead. You know? I'm over here expecting them to work the steps. Expecting them to get a spiritual life. Expecting them to get better. Oh, no. We must take the lead. You know? Oh, and they can, and they can be, it talks about they can be footsore. They can drag. They can take shortcuts. Well, of course they can. That's all we've ever done. Right? So, the beautiful thing is, if I keep having that demonstration in my home of these principles, this demonstration in my home, my affairs, my occupations, people do see the change. I can't beat them over the head with it. They just have to see it. And I love how many times, and I can't tell you how many times, but the book talks about we saw. We saw. We saw. It's constantly talking about we saw. We see what happens in Charlie. We see what happens in her. We see what happens in them. And then I know it can happen for me. It can happen for me. And that's what our family does too. They see that it can happen in us and maybe. Just maybe it's genuine for a change. 20 years of drinking will make a skeptic out of anyone. And we have a responsibility. And the beautiful thing is, we have been given this tremendous gift that we indeed, it tells me, what is this but a miracle of healing? God is always inclusive, never exclusive. You know, and the healing comes miraculously, breathtakingly, and constantly. And we get to sit here and be a part of that. We get to sit here and be a part of that. You know, people died, especially women. We didn't get sober. We were nervous. We were nervous. And we just died. And today we don't. Many of us do. Many of us do. But we don't have to. And you can come in here on Tuesday night. And isn't that a great miracle? But so the years go by. And you know, what happens? That same mother, because I only have one, you know, ends up entrusting me to take care of the paperwork on her deathbed. These are the kinds of changes that take place in our homes if we continue to demonstrate these principles. You know, I couldn't show up. I couldn't show up for a birthday party, much less a deathbed. Today, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the ability, the gift, the power to be able to show up for anything, no matter how sordid, no matter how sad, no matter how happy. I can show up for it. I don't know about anybody else, but that was what my alcoholism really looked like. It's a complete inability a complete failure to show up for anything. Talks about the manifestations of self, which caused our failure. Well, all I could think about was me. That's all I could ever think about. What about me? Swing right on over to, how about me? You know? And so I couldn't show up for you. I couldn't do anything for you. I couldn't give you anything. I couldn't do anything for you. And the only thing that happened is, as we all know, that self-loathing, that self-pity, that self-disgust. And we don't have to live like that anymore. And my 10 minutes are up. Thank you all for being here.
Told you she was pretty good, didn't I? You know, we've never done this before. We always have a short speaker and a long speaker. And last year we had a short speaker and a long speaker. And the guy that was the short speaker, after we were finished, we were like, kind of wish we could listen to him a little while longer. And so this year we were trying to figure out who the speaker was. DJ was our short speaker last year, and he's going to be our long speaker this year. And this is a guy we have a lot of common lineage together, and I know you're in for a treat tonight, and so without taking up any more of our time, I'm going to get DJS up here to talk to you. Come on.
My name is DJ. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hi, DJ.
And my sobriety date is November 3rd, the year 2000, and I'm I want to thank Charlie and Katie and everybody here at Primary Purpose for allowing me to do this. It's an absolute honor to be here tonight, and I mean that with all the sincerity in my heart. I want to thank Marty. I wish she'd have left the bar a little bit lower, but I'll just have to see what I can do. I guess the first place I'm going to start is, because it came up a bunch of times tonight, it was kind of funny, is the clothes. Because, I mean, I got to be honest with you guys. I mean, whenever I've done this before, I feel like a preacher in a Stephen King novel, and it's like, and if you're new, that's kind of what an AA talk is, you know. I'm not I'm not wearing this because I want to impress you guys, although I would like to impress you guys. I'm cool with that idea. The reason I'm wearing this is because it was what I was told to do. And there came a juncture and time in my life when I became willing to do what I was told to do. The thing that it kind of makes me calm, and I do it whenever I'm asked to do this, is on page 98 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says to burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only conditions is trust God and clean house. And those are some big conditions for a guy like me, you know. But the part of that sentence that's always stood out to me is this get well. And I hope to convey tonight a little bit of a glimmer of what I've learned about what getting well in Alcoholics Anonymous is. I'm not ashamed to say that I got well in Alcoholics Anonymous. How well that is, I don't know. I leave that for other people to say. But, you know, a couple pages before that in the book, it talks about in our personal stories, we share from our own point of view and in our own language exactly how it is that we came to have this relationship with God. And I'm going to try and leave some of my own language out because I feel it's probably not appropriate. But other than that, that's what I'm going to try and do. You know, I mean, because the bottom line is my story is all I've got. My experience is all I've got. I've been sober long enough now to realize that even my experience is subject to my perspective. And my past is, my perspective on my own past has changed as the years have gone by. That's just my truth in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's funny. I carry this thing with me. It's like a talisman because my heart is racing, you know. And this was where's Cal right there. She let me use her book before we got here. And then she was telling me the story of where she got this book, you know, that when her boyfriend had given it to her. And it made me think, if other people are giving you big books, you might be an alcoholic. Oh, that was awesome. The one thing I usually get out of the way right away is, for me, is I was born a Yankee. It's almost harder for me to say that than it is to come up here and say that I'm an alcoholic. I got down here as quickly as I could. I was born in upstate New York, little Yankee kid. My parents moved down here to Texas when I was about 13 years old, and I landed in Rio Hondo, Texas. Anybody in this room know where Rio Hondo, Texas is? I got a hand over there. It's down near Harlingen. It's in the Rio Grande Valley. So I moved from about 60 miles of Canada down to about 20 miles from Mexico. Little bit of a culture shock, you know. And if I was being honest with you guys about my youth, you know, what I remember of being a kid, it wasn't so much about, I mean, I hear different people describe this differently. What I remember is being incredibly self-conscious and not knowing that I was incredibly self-conscious. You know, I would have done anything. I was really worried about what other people think of me. Now, I was not aware that that's what was going on. In fact, in our book, in the doctor's opinion, it says our alcoholic life was the only normal one. And I believe that that applies to me in all the ramifications of what that sentence is saying. That this is the only experience I had. I think I was made this way. Previous to me ever taking a first drink. That's just my take. Again, you know, before I get off into this, you know, some of you guys, this is just my experience, my story, what happened to me. And it's going to be different than some of you people. Some of it, I hope, well, you can take that with a grain of salt. I hope that for some of you that there will be similarities there, you know. And then I think maybe I hope that maybe if there's not, you don't belong here. And I mean that with the utmost respect. What happened to me was at about 13 years old, I moved to South Texas. As a kid, I would have never been the guy who wanted to, believe it or not, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to be a hippie. I was not the clean-cut guy that you see standing before you today. I have never wanted to be a policeman. I have never wanted to be a fireman, a doctor, a lawyer, or any of those things. Dude, when I was 8 years old and I heard Ted Nugent play Cat Scratch Fever, it was on. And that was it. I mean, I'm not even kidding. I remember that moment. And it's all I ever wanted to do, you know. So I show up down in South Texas as a little kid. I'm walking to school for the first time because we live in the big city of Rio Hondo now. And on my way to school, I see some kids over there smoking cigarettes behind a gas station. And I have always been attracted to the darker side of life. I liked it, you know. And so next thing you know, I'm over there smoking cigarettes with these guys. And within a couple of days, I had my first drink. I was in it was a little reservoir outside of Rio Hondo, Texas, smoking a little weed, drinking a little alcohol. And it happened for me. What I mean by that is I'm sitting there very self-conscious. Where I'm a little skinny Yankee kid trying to fit in with these other kids. They're wearing cowboy hats and belt buckles, and one of them actually rides a horse to school. I'm a little bit nervous about the whole situation. And somewhere along the line, and I'm hating Texas, by the way. At that point, I'm just like, God, this place is like, it's like a desert. You know, and if any of you guys have ever been to Rio Hondo, it's not that far off. I mean, it's not a pretty place. I'm sure it's wonderful in its own way, but I'm just not digging it, you know. I'm just not digging it is the simplest way I could put it. And all of a sudden that alcohol hit me, and I'm thinking, everything got real calm. And I'm looking over there, and I'm going, you know, that mesquite tree's got a beauty all of its own. And you know what? These guys aren't so bad, and I'm pretty all right, too. And nothing bad happened that day, really. You know, the one event I can remember of that afternoon was I remember tipping over a Honda 50 motorcycle, coming up off that bike all skinned up and just laughing, brother. And everybody else is laughing, and they're not laughing at me, they're laughing with me. What I'm trying to say in a short sentence is I had a good time, you know. I really relate, and I identify with that. My experience is when I put alcohol in my body, I experience the promises that we read in this book. That's the type of experience that alcohol has always done for me. I'm not the guy who's going to stand up here and say, alcohol is bad. You will never hear those words coming out of my mouth. Because I like alcohol. I like the effect produced by it. And I made a decision right there on that day that I was going to do this as often as possible. Now, that was very conflicting to my parents. You know, they're Irish farmers from upstate New York. And then now all of a sudden DJ's down here and he's smoking dope and hanging out with what my mother would call unsavory characters. I think that she thought that if I was hanging out with those boys, something was going on. Something has changed in little DJ, you know. And so what it was is we did a little geographical tour there for a little bit. She decided that the best thing for me to do would be to go live with my sister. And she thought that would be better than me hanging out with these gentlemen. And just so happened my sister lives in Hawaii. So I learned to smoke better dope. And that's what I got out of that. A couple years later, I'm back in Texas again. Little DJ's getting in more and more troublesome. And at the age of 16, somewhere right around there, about 16, 17 years old, I came to Austin, Texas on a Wednesday night. And there was a free concert down in Auditorium Shores. And I will never forget that moment. I mean, I walk up to Auditorium Shores. There's people out there drinking, smoking pot, playing hacky sack. And Bill Wilson, I have arrived. I mean, and I've been in Austin ever since. I love this town. So, as like I said, it's a real honor to be. When they told me that I was out in treatment, and they told me I was going to have to come back to Austin and go to AA, I was like, I don't think they do that here. I've lived here a long time. I've never seen one. I thought I was going to end up going out to Bastrop or something like that. I'm glad I'll be able to find some of that A&A stuff. Because I'm shocked. And what happened was, and again, guys, I'm not going to try to deviate this, but I'm going to be as honest as I can. You know, because this is the value of exposing myself, if this helps one person. What happened for me was real simple. I mean, about that time and age in my life, I discovered this other thing. It was called methamphetamine. And I liked that stuff. You know, those are a few of my favorite things, as Earl would say, you know. It was when I got to Austin, and if you'd have asked me if I was a drug addict or not, I'd have never had a problem with that. Because all my heroes were drug addicts, you know, Jimmy Page, Jimi Hendrix. I'm like, drug addicts are cool. You know, now if you'd asked me if I was an alcoholic, I would not have thought that was so cool. Because in my mind, an alcoholic is a guy who listens to Merle Haggard, drives an old beat-up pickup truck, stops off at the Dew Drop Inn, beats his wife a couple times a week, and keeps on doing that same thing. And so in my mind, I can't possibly be an alcoholic because I like Led Zeppelin. There's just not a connection being made on that. And so, you know, needless to say, if I really was to think, I do believe identification is important. And there may be people here in this room that are that part of the process. Hopefully at this point, you know, maybe some of you guys are getting the idea that, yeah, I've drank and used drugs before. Honestly, no kidding. You know, I don't want to spend a long, long time about my experience around that. But I do believe that it's important that a person I needed to know from people in Alcoholics Anonymous that they had been there and done that. I couldn't have walked into a room with a bunch of disco drunks that were telling me, you know, that they didn't really like alcohol, that it was a bad thing. And they drank this bad substance and it ruined their lives. Brother, that's just me, okay? What it was for me, when I heard people saying, I like that stuff, I was like, right on, I knew I was in the right place. Because I did. You know, and what happened was, at about that time, if I was to go back to some moments in my life that led me to Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the ones that always sticks with me whenever I'm asked to do this is just a little peephole into my life. As I remember, you know, being in my early 20s, mid-20s, something like that, coming home one night, and my wife has been up all night. She's no longer my wife now. My ex-wife. We find a lot of those in AA. She's been crying because she doesn't know where I'm at. She doesn't know what's going on. She's in tears. It's about 3 in the morning. And I stagger into the house. She's sitting there on the couch. Get down on my knees and tell her I love you, Paula, and pass out. And that wouldn't really be a very tragic story, except her name is not Paula. That's a little glimpse of my behavior. That's the kind of things that I do. You know, I wake up the next morning and I'm like, what's up? You know? Again, did I mention she's my ex-wife? Right? You know? I don't think that it's necessary for a man or a woman to go to jail to be an alcoholic. I don't think that's part of what being an alcoholic is. I have a little bit of experience at that. You know, not a whole lot, but a little bit. My experience at jail was, and this is going to tie in here, hopefully. And segue this thing together. But my experience in jail was this. When the first time I felt that cell close, I was just terrified, like a cat. Kind of about the same heart rate I've got going right now. And didn't dig it, you know. I'm just like, second time, not quite so bad. Third time, I'm looking for the good bunk. You know what I mean? I'm up on the top, you know, I know what's going on. And what happens is, and this happened right before I got sober, is I remember hearing a guy say, Daniel Shea, ATW. And I remember getting up out of my bunk and being really excited because I know that you hear that in every institution. If you ever get locked up, there's a little trivia fact for you. It means all the way. It means I'm fixing to get out. And it occurred to me right about the time that my feet hit the ground that I am beginning to understand jail talk. You hear that? That's institutions. You know, that's part of, and for me, that's just it, dude. I'm one of those bad court-appointed alcoholics. You know, and that's why I kind of tie this together is when I was sober for a while and I began to learn the history about Alcoholics Anonymous, I found that there was many of those back in Alcoholics Anonymous and that there's nothing new going on here, which made me feel a little bit better. The fact of the matter is, you know, Ebbie Thatcher was in a courtroom when he was pulled out by Roland Hazard and began this process of the message that was actually delivered to Bill Wilson. I think is alcoholic number 5, if I'm not correct, maybe number 3, somewhere in the top 10, was also a court-appointed dude. So there's nothing new about court appointments in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's been going on for a long time. And that meant a lot to me, because then I didn't feel different or isolated. To get to this, to what exactly the event that occurred for me to get sober was, I'm coming home from my studio one night, and my ex-wife, right? She doesn't show up. I've been up for quite a while. I begin to get angry at her, and I have an epiphany at about 5 in the morning because I realize she had to have taken her clothes with her to go to work the next morning if she's going to show up to work. She works at HEB down there on Riverside Drive at the time. She did. And for some reason, I'm thinking that I'm going to show up down there and chew her out for her bad behavior. I mean, how dare could she just be gone and not tell me what's going on and take her... I mean, this is premeditated. I got her, you know? I mean, so, you know, when she shows up to work, I'm down there, buddy. I'm knocking on the door, ask her to step outside with me so that I could point out what she was doing wrong. And about 5 minutes into that conversation, I'm getting tapped on the shoulder by APD. And he wants to see my driver's license. He's not interested in her a bit. And I end up handing this guy a driver's license that's been expired for about 7 years. And he looks at my driver's license and he goes, Mr. Shea, he says, do you have any warrants out for your arrest? And my response was, I don't know. You see where this is going, right? And his response to me was, he says, Mr. Shea, he said, people who have warrants out for their arrest know that they have warrants out for their arrest. Long as short of that story is I ended up getting busted for possession of marijuana, methamphetamine and cocaine. They're putting me in the handcuffs, put me in the car, and the thought that goes through my mind is, look what she's done to me now. That was that last stint that I was talking about when I began to understand jail talk. Things were really coming together for me at this point in my life. You know, I get out of there, and to get to the court-appointed thing, what happened was I go to my attorney, because I have a attorney on retainer by this point in my life. I'm thinking, that's pretty normal, right? Everybody has a criminal attorney that's a friend of theirs. And this man was, I guess he was getting tired of dragging me out of that cell too, because he asked me, he said, DJ, do you have a drug problem? And for some reason that I have no idea where it came from or what, I basically said yes. So he appointed me to the Travis County Short Program. And I don't know if anybody in here knows what that means, and it's not really all that important, except that it was a vehicle that God used to lead me toward Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I went down to the Travis County Short Program, and I had a feeling they were going to make me put down those nasty drugs, you know. And at this point in my life, I'm thinking, you know, it's going to be me and Nancy Reagan, baby, all the way. I'm going to just say no. And I'm going to put those nasty drugs down, and I'm going to do what they tell me to do, because what they've offered me is this thing called being expunged. And I just love to say that word. It's just so cool. Because I know what that means. It means get out of jail free again. You know, get away with it. You know, put it off one more time. So I go down there to this place, and what happens is they have this big contract signed out to me, and that's the first time I started hearing the word the program. You know, I'd never heard that. I mean, it was kind of creepy looking back at it, my perspective. Because I'm thinking these people are going to be like the Borg. You know, some guys are familiar with Star Wars, you know. Thinking they're going to assimilate me. If you're new, resistance is futile. And they start telling me what I'm going to have to do to get this expunction. And it was one of those things was I'm going to have to go to those A&A meetings. You know, I'm going to need to go to some groups. I'm going to need to go to this thing called drug court. And of course, I know I'm going to do the inevitable peeing in the cup thing. know, I knew that was coming. That's why, like I said, me and Nancy Reagan are going to just say no and putting all that stuff down. And then I have to go to this thing called intensive outpatient. And just that word kind of scared me. Intensive outpatient. I'm like, oh, my God. What was really alarming to me, though, is down at the bottom of this contract where they were asking me to sign my name, at the very bottom of it, it says, no alcohol. And I recoiled from that piece of paper as if it were a hot flame. And I began to immediately explain to this woman the importance of alcohol in my life. And I didn't, I would just, because I wasn't sure if she had noticed that my arrest had nothing to do with alcohol. Marijuana, cocaine, methane, amphetamine, I understand. You know, we're going to put that stuff away. That's bad. But my last name is Shea, I'm Irish, and I need to drink, lady. You know, that's the bottom line of this. And she looks me dead in the eye. And the thing about the Travis County Short Program at the time I went through is it's completely run by recovered alcoholics, right down to the judge. They saw me coming, brother. If I'd have known that, I probably never would have went. But I didn't even know what that was then. I didn't know what that was. So to make a long story short and get through to the bottom of this thing, I finally signed that piece of paper. And I'm and in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, okay, Nancy, it's me and you. I'm going to suck this thing up. I'm going to do it for a year. And then I'm going to go back about my business. I'm not even out of the building. And oh, yeah, there's one more caveat that's kind of important. It says, if I can't stay sober, please lock me up. Because they have another program. It's called the SMART program. That's the gist of the contract I signed. The ink is not even dry on this piece of paper. I'm leaving the building, going down the elevator, and the thought crosses my mind, you know what? They're not going to follow me around, you know? I'm getting a little distance between me and that scary lady I was talking to. And I'm a little bit of reason's coming back to me, you know? And I'm thinking, they're not going to know if I take a drink. What I didn't know at the time was that, see, I have a problem when I drink. I am unable to control the amount that I drink every time I drink. Sometimes I can, but I can't always. And I get sloppy, I get drunk. And the truth is, I don't even like being sloppy drunk. You know, I have a solution for that. It's called methamphetamine. Do some of that, boom, you know, we're ready to go again. But I have a little problem that I'm not aware of with methamphetamine. It's I have trouble controlling the amount of that stuff I do every time I do it. But I have a solution for that, you know. It's like it makes me a little twitchy. I smoke a little weed, you know. And it takes the edge off of that. And I always say that, and it's just the truth. For me, I was no stranger to the triangle concept. Because then I smoke a little weed, and I got some really bad cotton mouth, and the next thing you know, I'm drinking again. And that's just what I do. That's my life. So now I've signed this contract with these people. I'm not even out of the building. By the time an hour had gone by, I'd taken a first drink, so I'm caught back in that triangle again. And it's what I do. And now all of a sudden, I'm sitting back going, wow, what the is going on? I don't go to any of those A&A meetings they tell me to go to. That's way too radical. Besides, as at that point, I don't even know if they have them here in Austin yet, right? I'm thinking I got to drive out in Bastrop and check that out. And so what happened was I go to this intensive outpatient thing, and I remember very well getting there and this lady walking up to me and she says, hi, my name's Pam. I'm an alcoholic. What's your drug of choice? And my actual response to this woman was, what do you got? I thought she was offering to get high. You know, I'd never heard that term drug of choice, which even to this day makes no sense to me. We'll invoke Mark for a second, shall we? Mark says that my drug of choice is Excedrin because I can choose to do a few of them and then put it away. But again, guys, at this point in my life, I don't know anything about alcoholism at all. I'm just having some experiences. I'm having some bad luck. You know, some stuff's going on for me. So now I've done this. I end up, you know, of course, you can see the rest of that unravel very quickly. I failed the UA, blah, 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 blah. Next thing you know, they're slamming me in this treatment center. And what happened for me was I met a man who entire deportment shouted, here's a man who had a solution. And what that looked like is I saw this kid. He was going on and on. He was very, very excited. And I was able to key in on that. I mean, this guy's excited about something. What he was excited about was this thing he called the Big Book. And my first thought was, that is not a very big book. You know, I'm a reader. I can handle this. You know? And I spent some time listening to this guy. And he started talking about these three things over and over and over again. He started talking about the phenomenon of craving, physical allergy, how it affected my body. And I began to look back on my experience of how that was, you know. Then, you know, the first thing that really came to my mind was he started talking about the mental obsession. You know, physical craving to me, the best way I know how to explain it is like everybody in this room right now is experiencing the phenomenon of craving. Every single person. You're experiencing the phenomenon of craving for oxygen. You're not aware of it, but if I was to walk up behind you and put a plastic bag over your head, you would immediately become aware of your phenomenon of craving for oxygen. You know, so if when you run out of alcohol, you feel like that, hey, go, you better take a look at that. That made sense to me. Because I'm not aware of the phenomenon of craving while I'm drinking. It's when I run out that the panic sets in. I'm the guy who's, how can I say this? We'll just say it, right? I'm the guy who loves a nice hot beer at about 6 in the morning. You know what I mean? But the problem is I only have a couple left from last night, so I need to be at the convenience store at 7. I'm the guy that's waiting for them to unlock the chains. I'm like, sir, do you realize it's 7:01? I need to get to work. Keep the show on the road here. That's me. I mean, phenomenon of craving. Once I put it in my body, I cannot control the amount that I drink every time. And I started looking at this piece, and I began to think, I kind of had a sinking feeling. You know, I'm like, wow, okay, that's not good. But I love the fact that he said, there's three things that make you an alcoholic. I was like, well, one, that's, hey, maybe I'll get lucky on these other two. You know, he starts talking about this thing, the mental obsession. You know, have I lost the power to choose and whether I'm going to drink or not? And my thoughts were, I was like, thank God. Because that doesn't apply to me. You know, I mean, and the honest thing is, the first thoughts I had is that, like, because I'm not losing the power of choice. I just change my mind a lot. You with me? I'm a mind-changing guy. My experience is that the first time that UA came up, I could not make it from South Austin to North Austin to take a urinalysis without drinking 3 beers on the way. And I'm thinking a normal person might wait until after they had taken the urinalysis to drink the 3 beers. And it was occurrences like that, as I looked back in my experience, that kept flashing through my mind as I heard this guy talking about this thing. And then when he finally got down to the basis of this entire process of this thing called the spiritual malady, it does not even begin until I stop drinking. I remember the first time the idea was presented to me, it was like, DJ, are you irritable, restless, and discontent? And my response was, no, I'm pissed. Because I'm stuck in here in a treatment center with a bunch of people who look like they genuinely need to be here. You know, I'm buying that. I mean, because I've heard you guys' stories. I mean, it's tragic. You're a mess. And it's wonderful that they have places like this for you to go. I mean, it's cool. You know, I'm here because I'm in a little bit of legal difficulties. The coolest thing that happened was the guy told me, he said, dude, if you're not sure about this information, he said, stick with me and just keep listening. And I spent about 30 days listening to this guy. And my first thoughts were, he is so excited. He is either on something or he is onto something. And I became convinced in that short amount of time that he was onto something, because he began to talk about this thing. And by the time that 30 days was over, I was convinced. Me, to my innermost self. I remember the moment that it happened when he was talking about this. I literally started weeping in the middle of a room full of guys like you. I mean, I'm like off in the middle of the room. And I mean, I just duck out of the room, dude, because I don't know anything. If I don't know anything at all, crying in front of a bunch of strangers is just not cool. You know what I mean? So then the next thing you know, I'm out behind this little shed that's out there in this place. Because I knew that I had been had. I knew that the truth of the first 60 pages of this book applied directly to me. And I knew that I was going to drink again. Not because I wanted to, but because I truly knew what that meant to be an alcoholic. To lose the power of choice, which applies to me the same today as it did then. I know that I will drink again. There's no question in my mind. What I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous when I got to that point was, then I was ready to hear, there is a solution to that problem. When I fully conceded to my innermost self that when I drink more than I intend to, and that I had lost the power to choose, which means I don't have the power to keep it out of me, because I will just change my mind. You know, I'll draw a line in the sand, and then another line in the sand, and I'm going to drink again. It's inevitable. It is inevitable for a guy like me. And then when I understood the spiritual malady, I understood exactly why it is inevitable. Because the first time I heard the word sobriety, I remember it like it was yesterday. I get a knot in my stomach. I don't even dig the sound of that word. I'm like, ugh, gut punch. You know, especially when they put another word with it. It's stay sober. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. That's my reaction to that little thing. And that's how I was able to realize that that is the true nature of my problem. The reason I'm never going to attain long-term sobriety is because I don't dig it. Never have. The reason that the idea occurs to me, the book says that the insanity around the first drink, it always has a certain plausibility to it. It's the insane idea has a parallel plausibility to it. And it's like that trip to the UA that I was talking about. Because the idea that allowed me to put that drink in my body that time there was, you know what, they're going to expect me to fail the first one. Right? And I could look back over my life, and that's always the type of reasoning that's going to allow me to put that first one in my body. The book clearly states that as the insanity that precedes the first drink. You know, I was shocked when I heard it. No, they didn't expect me to fail the first one. They fully expected me to pass that urinalysis with flying colors. And as I began to see this stuff, not just in pages on a book, but in my own experience, in my own life, what happened was I became a believer that I was going to drink again. And for me, the book says, given a sufficiently strong reason, it's trying to define the difference between a heavy drinker and a real alcoholic. Given a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, warning of a doctor becomes operative, a hard drinker can either stop or moderate. Now, a sufficiently strong reason for a guy like DJ is the possibility of a romantic relationship with somebody in Huntsville State Prison. You with me? That's a sufficiently strong reason to me. I'm like, you would think that I would keep that stuff out of my body. Because I can't think, you know, just off the top of my head, that's a bad thing. And there I am, I'm doing it over again. And that's how I knew that I had been had. And at that moment, then I was ready to hear the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my experience around that, guys, is, you know, I'm not going to lie to you. I didn't have a problem with God when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't. In fact, if it would have been about anything else, I probably would have fought that harder. You know, there was what I do remember was standing in the circle for the first time in my life with a bunch of you guys, and they were saying the Lord's Prayer out loud, and I knew that I was home. I knew it, because I'd never heard that prayer out loud before. I'd seen it, and I'd read it, and I thought about it, but I'd never heard it uttered by other human beings while I held their hands. Obviously, I wasn't raised in church. You know, in my family, it wasn't God was good, it wasn't God was bad. It just wasn't nothing. You know, it was, you know, pull your bootstraps up like I told you, Irish farmers, buddy. So for in that experience, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, what happened was, after meeting this gentleman who is not my sponsor today, I look back on it, it's so funny. I remember walking up to a man and saying, "Have you had a spiritual experience as a result of the 12 steps? And he looked at me and he said, "Yes. As a matter of fact, yes, I have." And I asked him, "Do you think you could help me have one of those?" And he said, "Yes. As a matter of fact, yes, I can." And I began the journey of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's been a wonderful experience for me. I got sober. That was at the Living Faith Club in South Austin. And I was the only newcomer in that meeting. It wasn't a big meeting. It wasn't anything. I'd walk in there, and it was the same people that were there every day. And they would share the meetings around what step I was on and guide me. And I just thought that's the way AA was, brother. You know, I was like, this is wonderful. I was shocked when they sent me to other clubs. I mean, I was. I mean, because I was under the impression that why in the hell would somebody come to Alcoholics Anonymous and not work the steps? I didn't even know that was an option. I remember sitting drinking coffee with a girl. There you go. And she's explaining to me how she's been in the program for 12 years, and, you know, we're drinking coffee, and I'm thinking, this is wonderful. I had never been asked to go drink a cup of coffee before in my entire life, by the way. You know, that was like a new experience for me. I thought she was hitting on me, but no, she just wanted to drink coffee. I wasn't too sure about that. And she's explaining to me how she's been in the program for 12 years and how wonderful Alcoholics Anonymous is and blah, blah, blah. Somewhere along the conversation, I have, again, another epiphany, and I realize I have more sobriety than this chick does. Do you with me? That you know, you hear a lot of talk about previous links of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I mean, the longest previous link of sobriety I ever had was when I was 12 years old. And then I hit 13, and that's the one that led me here. I've been sober since the day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't think that's because I'm good or because I'm special. I do firmly believe that the guy who conveyed the message, the information in this book, it doesn't say self-knowledge avails you nothing. That's kind of the way I've always heard that. But there was some knowledge that I needed to have and be able to internalize to be true for me before I would have become willing to do the work that this book asks me to do. Because this stuff is drastic. I realized that when I read it. These people are going to expect me to pay the money back to people that don't even know I have stole it. That's a problem for a guy like me. They're going to expect me to turn myself in. I've always said that, dude. I mean, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so... I couldn't even convey it in words. I think that the 13th promise of Alcoholics Anonymous should be the fear of police will fall from you. See, that was something I could sink my teeth into. Because I'm the guy, when the cop comes up behind me, my whole life, whether he's actually pulling me over or not, real or fancy, the book says, right? My heart rate jumps up about 35 beats a minute. You know, it never occurred to me that's because I was a criminal. You know, I mean, I have a valid driver's license in my pocket today. My car that I'm driving's got the right stickers on it. There's gasoline in it. And I think that once in a while, I just like to wave to cops, you know, because I'm free to do so and relaxed enough that that's my experience. But I will tell you that. It's like my sticker goes out of my car, that fear comes right on back. That's been my experience with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This thing's about action. And the actions that I take allow me to have a certain result that has changed my perception of reality. And that all leads back to that very first place that I started with this, is that's what alcohol always did for me. It altered my perception of reality immediately. And what has happened as a result of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, being hanging with you guys, and actually doing this thing, is that my perception has changed. I've learned that, and I've been through some stuff that, you know, I'm not the guy going to stay up here and say that it's always rainbows and sunshine shooting out, you know, those kind of places. I've gone through some tough stuff in AA, you know. Seriously, I've watched other people die that I loved, you know, that could not and would not submit themselves to this thing that we have. And it's gut-wrenching. I've watched people who die who did submit themselves. I've seen people die in Alcoholics Anonymous with more grace than people I watched live. There's a man... His name's Nate. I don't know why I'm going to go in there for just a second. Nate was there in my first year of sobriety. I got sober after I was allowed to release from Living Faith and told to go forth into the community of Alcoholics Anonymous in Austin. I wound up at the Old Suburban Club at the North Lamar, right across from the Yellow Rose, the Texan Motel, and the liquor store. Dude, I loved that place. I mean, it was my kind of people, brother. And they didn't say to me, you need to have a year sober. They were like, come on, brother, we need the help. Answer the phone. Clean the coffee cups. Go talk to that guy over there. And there was wet drunks walking. It was great. They kept the doors open. There'd be people sitting up there till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Good old wrist slasher AA meetings at 11:30. I mean, it was just a perfect place for me. I mean, I was going to 3 or 4 meetings a day because I didn't have any place else I didn't have any other life. Joe told me that if you go to AA trying to get something, what you're going to get is sick, because AA is full of sick people. He said, your job is to try to go to AA and give something, and you will get well. And so on that note, you know, about, I don't know, probably about 90 days, somewhere in my first 6 months, I remember I had broken my ankle. I would lost my job. I'm being evicted from my house on this very day. And as I'm being evicted, I'm asking somebody to give me a ride up to that suburban club. And by that time, I had gotten far enough involved in the work that what I remember happening was, dude, I want to go into this meeting because I need to share with you guys what's going on in my life. I've got some things happening. But I couldn't get past that thing in my head that I heard Chris say to me. It's like, if you will just take your stuff and set it down in that half measures room and spend 1 hour, just 1 hour, talking about this book and what it's done for you, things will happen. And I couldn't get that out of my head. So, of course, the meeting's about 5 minutes late because, you know, those damn people at AA. So I chaired the meeting. I start talking about physical craving, spiritual malady, mental obsession, da-da-da-da. And this guy comes up to me after the end of the meeting and he says, DJ, will you sponsor me? And my thought is, buddy, if you want what I have, you know, because he has no idea. I take him in a little back room, you know, and we're talking about, I start talking to him again about physical craving, mental obsession, spiritual malady, and he stops me in the middle of that little pitch, and he goes, DJ, that's all good. That's good stuff. He says, but I've got a real problem. He said, I've got to go into treatment tomorrow, and I need somebody to watch my house for 90 days. And I learned that, brother. If I'm willing to chop the wood, carry the water in Alcoholics Anonymous, focus on you guys, first and foremost, over everything, that God's got my back. And I've never gone without a roof over my head. I've never gone without food. There's been times when I thought it was pretty close. My first year of sobriety was hard, man. And it wasn't so that bad things were happening to me. It was just the wreckage of my past had become my present. I mean, my life is still a moving train wreck. The pieces haven't even all landed yet. You know what I mean? And it's just the truth. But what I learned is that my troubles really, truly did arise out of myself. Somebody showed me how to see that. And I was allowed to be free of I, because there's something wonderful about that. There's just something incredibly wonderful. Because if you guys really are the problem, I am really screwed. What I learned was, through the inventory process, that I'm not a victim, I'm a volunteer. I had set myself up, and I was stepping on the toes of others, and they had retaliated, and my troubles really did arise out of myself. And then I got the opportunity to start cleaning up the wreckage of my past. And I had moved up to North Austin. I'll try and wrap this up pretty quick. I had moved up to North Austin because I thought that the apartment I was living in probably didn't have room for me, my wife, and her new boyfriend. You know, I'm thinking, that's not going to be real conducive to what I'm trying to do. So now I'm living up in North Austin. And on that particular note, you know, it was one of the nice things that happened to me in the first year of sobriety. I remember a night, dude, and I'm not going to lie to you guys. I thought I really wanted to drink. And I went to it's now some other store, but it was a 7-Eleven at the corner of St. John's and I-35. And again, it was in my first year somewhere in that time. And I remember walking in that store, and I was just like, dude, I can't do this. It's just too much. It's just too much. And I walked into there, and I got up to the alcohol, and I couldn't do it. I literally could not make my arms move to open that door to take that alcohol out of that cooler. It was like a wall of flame went across that thing. And I'm crying, brother. I mean, really, real tears. I mean, I'm standing in front of that cooler, and I'm just weeping. And it's just, there's only two people in the store, me and the clerk, you know. I'm crying, and he's frightened. I end up walking past that dude, back out into my car, sitting down in the car, and I suddenly realized that God had done for me the thing I could never, ever do for myself. And I became rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence that this book talks about. Because then it wasn't just words on a page. This stuff was happening to me. The thing that the book says, one of my favorite pieces of it, and it says a lot of things, but it's talking about perception. My perception and my relationship to the universe and the power that guides it. You know, it says Dr. Jung was talking to I guess it was Roland Hazard, actually, that who he was talking to. And he said that ideas, attitudes, and emotions that were once the guiding forces in these people's lives are suddenly cast aside, and an entirely different set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. And that's what began to happen in my life. These different ideas that I've been trying to share with some people tonight began to dominate me. And not just in my head, but in my actual behavior. Because I remember Joe telling me again, you know, that you can't, how do you word it? You hear it all the time in AA. I couldn't think my way into right acting. I had to learn to act my way into right thinking. There's Bob over there. I love that. Bob says it best. Monkey see, monkey do. This is real simple. And they showed me how to do this. And as I began to take those behaviors that this book is precisely guides me on, it tells me exactly what I need to do to get that result. And the result has been that result that happened to me that night in the 7-Eleven. That if tempted, we recoil from it as if it were a hot flame. It doesn't say I'm thinking my way through the drink. It doesn't say to try to remember the bad shit that happened to me and, oh, I'll just put that down. Because what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is not only is your bad stuff not enough to stop me from taking a drink, my bad stuff is not enough to stop me from taking a drink. So why we spend an enormous amount of time talking about the bad stuff doesn't really make all that much sense. Physical craving, mental obsession, spiritual malady. Every alcoholic, a real alcoholic, I've come to believe that. I've been here long enough. Whether it's an older lady who drank wine, whether it's a crazy hippie like me who did a lot of outside issues along with their alcohol, they're going to understand that kind of language. That's the language of the first 60 pages of this book, that I had to become convinced. In fact, I would even use the word convicted. The book says no lurking notion that I will ever be able to do that again with success. Paraphrase pretty much. But that idea had to be smashed. And the only way I knew how to smash it was by another person who was properly armed with the facts about himself and knew exactly what was in this book, transmitted that information to me, and I began to analyze it against my own past. Because it wasn't something that was going to happen in the future. My own past told me the truth. And on that theme, I've become convinced. I don't even trust what I believe today, what goes on in my head. That is not an indicator of what DJ really believes. Not what comes out of my mouth, not what I think in my head. But I can always turn around and look at my behavior, and that will tell me my truth. That is what I believe. It's irrefutable. It's a fact. You know, I can't dodge my own behavior. What goes on in my head sometimes is kind of still scary to this day. You know, that's just the truth. You know, I've learned that it's not a real reliable resource that God gave me up there. You know, my brain. You know, they told me it was for stuff like counting change, knowing when to go through the green light. You know, that's what that particular resource was for. I'm going to close with this. Again, I mean, I can't state to you guys if you're new here. This thing, I didn't believe it. I was going to prove them wrong. I'll try your AA stuff. That's cool. When my year's up, I'm out of here. Because I got better shit to do. And I'm still here. So if you're new, prove me wrong. Get in this thing. Which Laura was another, I mean, I've had all these visions of these people that gave me these things. Laura used to say it all the time. If you're in Alcoholics Anonymous, get in the middle of this thing. Don't hang around on the edge because people on the edges fall off. You know, I mean, I learned to have service commitments. I got involved in a home group. You know, I went through every one of those positions. I learned about the traditions. And most vitally, at the end of the day, I started sponsoring guys. Not because I'm good, but because the book says, this is... How does it phrase it? Watching newcomers recover is an experience you must not miss. It doesn't say it's optional. It doesn't say, hey, you might want to try that. That's a really cool thing. It says, this is an experience you must not miss. In other words, until I had come to the entire revolution of this thing, and I got to see another man, no matter how inadequately I presented this, and no matter what I did, that was experiencing the same thing that I was experiencing. That I realized that this had become, and I believe this to this day, Alcoholics Anonymous is the most profound thing that has ever happened to me. It is the most profound thing that ever will happen to me. Because there are men, as a result of the little bit that I've tried to do, and however inadequately that was, whose lives are better and their children are in a better home. And I don't even know those men, because this message has been passed on down the line many times in the last 11 and a half years. I know that to be a fact. I remember the first time I sponsored a guy, I watched him sponsor a guy, and watched him sponsor a guy. And you can't get that without doing this thing. Realizing that for the first time, what I was thinking of when I was a kid is I wanted to play Madison Square Gardens, and I needed a million people screaming at me, telling me that I was okay. And I knew I still wouldn't have been okay. Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to be okay. If this were my last day on earth, I have lived. And that is a direct result of everything that this program has given me. And I want to thank you guys again for allowing me to be here tonight. And I'm honored. Thank you.